Hey, ain't you the Babellus who drinks mediocre coffee?
I don't do that no more.
You ain't Batman.
I don't drink mediocre coffee anymore since I started drinking Sparkplug coffee. I love great coffee, and I know that the secret to making the very best coffee is making it while the beans are still freshly roasted. But most coffee you get from shops or the shelves of your grocery store are roasted months before they get to you. Thankfully, the internet has solved this problem with sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced through direct and fairly traded methods. They have many blends to choose from to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. And they deliver this delicious coffee right to your door. But the best part is that their coffee is always delivered within a week of being custom roasted right here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
Action.
It's a hell of a thing recording a podcast. Howdy, movie lovers, and much obliged for downloading the Top 113 project as we head down the final stretch. Only 10 more to go in our analysis of the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you're unwise to the wicked ways of this film, get out now because we won't be holding nothing back, you hear? I am Ryan Ellis with the lady who can shoot the eye out of a bird flying, my spouse Bev.
That's me.
She and Morgan Freeman can do that. As they say, more than once in this film. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Unforgiven. How many people does Will Money gun down during the movie?
Alright, I'm probably wrong, because I'm usually wrong, but by my count, it was 8. 7 in the tavern plus Davy Boy.
This is the first time I've asked this trivia question without knowing the answer before we saw the movie. I counted 6. Beauchamp says he shot 5 men single-handedly in the shootout at the end, and he's the one who kills Davy.
He shot 5 guys single-handedly after he killed Skinny. That's the shootout, but he kills Skinny first.
This is the 8th then.
By my count, he shot 6, but I guess Beauchamp says 5, and then Davy Boy, so I was off by 1.
Maybe we don't have our facts straight on this question, do we? The reason why I wanted to ask it is because so many of Eastwood's westerns over the years, we would have had to keep a counter through the movie to keep up with it. And in this one, it's pretty much one shootout and that one painful bloody death for the young kid who's first shot at by Ned Logan, but it's Will Money who puts him out of his misery by shooting him in the gut. So a half dozen or maybe a few more, but really for a Western and for an Eastwood character, not as many as you might have thought, because almost all of them are in the tavern shootout at the very end. Okay, the Top 100 Project's 113th motion picture, Unforgiven, was 98th on the 1998 Top 100, between Hepburn flicks, Bringing Up Baby, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Then it rocketed up 30 spots to 68th in 2007 between Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Tootsie. Unforgiven was released by Warner Brothers on August 7th, 1992. Critics liked it, and audiences made the low-budget picture a bona fide success. Bev will describe Unforgiven for you now with The Skinny.
Clint Eastwood is retired gunfighter Will Money, who's trying to forget his bloody past as he raises his 2 young children alone. After learning of an opportunity to earn a reward for killing 2 men who attack some prostitutes, he rides off with old friend Ned Logan, played by Morgan Freeman. They're not what they used to be, and they're definitely not prepared for how Sheriff Little Bill Daggett, played by Gene Hackman, handles bounty hunters.
Or in a nutshell, pig farmer becomes job creator after wiping out police force. Oh, the rich people would love that job creator line, wouldn't they? Okay, a little bit of number action for Unforgiven. The Rotten Tomatoes critics love this movie so much. 95% of them said yes, 79% fresh, only 4 rotten, and 94% of audiences. The movie barely missed the 1992 top 10 of the U.S. box office. It was 11th. Aladdin was number 1 by quite a bit. But Unforgiven stayed in theaters for nearly a year, so obviously people liked it enough to keep on going. More of an old-fashioned kind of thing, when movies would stay in theaters for a very long time. Now you'd never see a movie that was a pretty good success stay in a theater for any more than about 4 months.
One of those rotten reviews, by the way, was Gene Siskel.
Right, he didn't like the movie.
Yeah, he gave it 2.5 stars, barely a rotten review, but he didn't like it.
And this was supposed to sum up Eastwood's violent career in westerns, the spaghetti westerns in particular, and also High Plains Drifter, Hang 'Em High, Outlaw Josie Wales. I forget how many he made, but it was a lot of westerns. And it's really one of those one last job movies all over again. We haven't seen that much on the project here and there. We've seen that an awful lot of movie history, though, probably thousands of times by now. And it doesn't work out all that well yet again, because usually one last job movies see one or many people end up dead. All right, well, Bev, What are your thoughts on Unforgiven?
Unforgiven's great. It has everything. It's entertaining and it's moving and it's deep. Clint Eastwood, as usual, plays to the cheap seats a little more than I like. He could probably stand to trust his audience a little more to catch on the subtleties. But I forgive his stylistic choice because he really does something new and interesting and mature and imperative for the Western genre.
And that's a fitting word to use, mature, because he put this script in a drawer for a long time. Mm-hmm. He wanted to grow into it. He was about 61 or so when they shot the movie. And there you go. He's almost a senior citizen, and he needed to be for this role to work.
He waited 15 years till he could get old enough to play it.
The script by David Webb Peoples, who had done Blade Runner for us, or at least one of the writers on that, way back when. Yeah. And then one of my favorites, 12 Monkeys. He hasn't made a lot of other movies as a writer, but he has those three terrific titles.
Eastwood was also saving it because he knew that he wanted this to be his last Western. He wanted it to be an elegy for Westerns and the word to end it all.
A lot of people have tried to do that. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, the John Ford Western, was not his last one, I don't think, but it was definitely his last great one, and it's also a movie that cuts the legs out from under Western films.
And The Wild Bunch tried to do that, too.
Was Peckinpah trying to make the last Western? But maybe everyone wants to make that ultimate statement, which in effect ends the genre, and yet who's got a Western coming out? A big-name director, in fact, in just a few months, Quentin Tarantino, who's already made one anyway with Django Unchained, but also a Civil War movie, so it's kind of a combination of the two. This movie he's got coming out, The Hateful Eight, sounds to me like it's just a Western, and it would be a very bloody one at that. And speaking of bloody, that makes me think of R-rated. I forgot how many swears are in this movie. There's an awful lot of the word fuck. They use it in the context of having sex. They use it in the context of an adjective. So we can say the word yet again, surprisingly. And if swearing is an authentic touch in that you're in, I suppose it is. So is the constant rain in this film. I think there's three different sequences that are set in pouring rain, including the very end of the movie. Women are just property. The women in the movie aren't gorgeous. The ones that are the primary part of the movie are prostitutes, and none of them are really all that good looking by what we think are prostitute standards.
Yeah, they're not Hollywood pretty. The only other woman we see is Ned's wife.
And she certainly isn't Hollywood pretty either. And she's pretty pissed that Ned's going off on this little adventure. The movie is set in 1880 Wyoming, but it was shot in Calgary in August and into November of 1991. So that's why you have some snow. There probably shouldn't have been. The movie is set, well, trivia question for you. Give or take, when is the movie set? What month? And time, what famous American time of year? I guess I'm giving that away.
I don't know.
July 4th, because when little Bill beats up on English Bob, he says, "You talking about the Queen on Independence Day?"
Oh.
As he starts kicking him.
How do they rationalize how bad the weather is?
No, they're probably high up north enough, I guess. But Eastwood just went with something that actually happened in Calgary. They had snow when he's recovering from that brutal beating he takes from little Bill after English Bob had taken one earlier in the picture. And Eastwood was the kind of guy that just went with what he had, and it actually is a very nice touch, whether or not it makes complete sense or not in the middle of the summer.
It's not the type of detail that I think audiences are ever going to dwell on.
Well, we're in the mountains, God knows. The snow could land anywhere. But these guys do look miserable a lot of the time, and that's why Money gets sick, has the flu by the looks of it, from being out in the cold and the rain.
That's how he first meets the Angel of Death, before he becomes the Angel of Death himself.
Nice touch, exactly. I said the movie was set in 1880 Wyoming. That means it's 17 years after Dances with Wolves, because that was set in 1863. They both then have that element in common, as does The Searchers, a previous AFI film, one of the most beloved ones, also a Western, just after or around the time frame of the Civil War. Morgan Freeman, Ned Logan's death, what happens to him? He's whipped to death.
Mm. They don't really address that he's black ever in the film. Nobody ever says it out loud, but that has to be intentional when he's chained up and little Bill's whipping him.
Right after the Civil War were taking place, when a guy like him wouldn't have thought twice about doing that to a guy who looks like Morgan Freeman. There's an awful lot of yin and yang in the movie, too. First, you got money, which is spelled M-U-N-N-Y. Mm-hmm. But what is he after in this movie? Real money, M-O-N-E-Y. So there's that yin and yang. And also the names Little Bill, so Bill, and then Will Money. And incidentally, in the IMDb, it does say Bill Money. That's got to be a mistake. He very clearly is called Will by Ned many, many times, and by James Wolvie's character, his other partner in this little quest, the Schofield Kid. But still, the symbiosis of Bill and Will, who are protagonists and antagonists in this movie, and also nominated for the heroes and villains, each of them, is this debatable? In fact, I'm saying it's debatable, that Little Bill's the villain, according to AFI, and Will is the hero, according to AFI, and yet really, if you look at this even slightly from the outside of the story, is that not upside down?
In another version of the film, Little Bill would be the hero, and Money would be the villain, and it would be easy. All you'd have to do is change the ending around so that Little Bill was victorious in that last shootout, and you would have the exact same movie, but with him as the hero.
And there's so many nice touches that make Little Bill both a sadist, although you disputed me when I brought that up during the movie. So let's just say a very tough cop, maybe overly tough cop.
I don't think that he enjoys inflicting violence. I don't think he's personally affected by violence the way a normal remorseful person would be, but I don't think he's a sadist. What he enjoys a great deal is the power that is the result of that violence. People are afraid of him. It gives him this unquestionable authority, and he loves that.
And isn't it curious that Gene Hackman plays this character? Because we talked about this last week, Silence of the Lambs. He was originally going to direct that and starred in as Hannibal Lecter. But he didn't like violence. He never did. And when he saw the clips of himself in the Mississippi burning Oscar night, which would have been in 89, he said, I don't want to do that kind of thing anymore. So he pulled out of Silence of the Lambs because he didn't want to play a character who really doesn't do much on screen that way. Maybe he would have done that movie differently. And then he goes on to this movie. Eastwood had to convince him to do it. And I guess the idea was, let's make a comment. Together, let's make a comment on what this guy really is. And I guess they're saying then that he is the bad guy if they're going to make this comment.
And he's the sheriff, so he should be the good guy.
Which also turns the movie up on its head, for sure. So you've seen the movie more than once. What is your absolute for sure take, or do you have an absolute for sure take on who is the good guy and who is the bad guy? Or is it better that we really can't be sure? Because let's not forget, before you answer, that we see him beat the living shit out of English Bob, but that's also for things that happened before. He tells stories about knowing the guy in the past, and he also does beat the living shit out of Will. Although both of them do lie about having weapons, and they're very clearly not supposed to have weapons in the town.
You know what? Him and Will, they're both bad people. English Bob is a bad person. You can questionably say what good or bad about Ned or about the Schofield kid, and even about the prostitutes and how they're so insistent on vengeance, or Davy Boy, who dies just because he helped his friend out when he probably
should have. Maybe the nicest character in the whole movie.
The most tragic death in the film. Who's a villain? Who's a hero? It's ambiguous because it's supposed to be. You're supposed to wonder about it. The audience is supposed to feel weird about enjoying the success of money. Because film after film has been made with Clint Eastwood as the star. He's playing very much on his own persona. And unfortunately, I'm not really familiar with his persona. I haven't seen the Dirty Harry movies. It's just not my jam. I'm not enough of a Western fan to have seen too many traditional Westerns. As a matter of fact, all the Westerns I've seen seem to be the ones that subvert the genre. So I probably have this weird perspective.
A genre you've liked on this podcast and the history
of
it so far.
I've liked it so much, but I have a feeling if I watch really traditional, heroic Westerns,
John Wayne or Eastwood's
Westerns, right, that I wouldn't like them at all. But the ones that we've been watching have been the ones that have been doing something smarter than that.
Isn't that interesting then that we said David Webb Peoples wrote this and he wrote Blade Runner? And in both cases, the heroes and villains were nominated for the lists, and we disputed in both cases who's the hero and who's the villain. So maybe none of them should have been nominated.
But I think right there, what they're saying is the most interesting heroes and the most interesting villains are the ones that toe that line and just are barely good enough to be heroes or barely good enough to be villains. Those are interesting characters. I love Little Bill. He has enough character and quirks to make him relatable. He's brutal and he's bad and he's scary, but he's also fallible and he's admirable in a way. Just relatable enough for the audience to wonder who their real villain is.
It's a nice touch as well that he's a terrible carpenter. He's not one of those guys that's good at everything. Here's another movie as well with our main character, Will Money. We've said it so many times in the podcast of the 70s and the 80s. They really started getting this in a big way. And I mentioned Mel Gibson literally says this in the first Lethal Weapon movie. It's the only thing I was ever good at. Well, Will very clearly is terrible at everything else. He's an absolutely awful pig farmer.
All
and hates
his
doing
pigs
it.
Got the fever.
Yeah. And Little Bill is not only not a very good carpenter, he's an awful carpenter. He's completely incapable of that.
I love
but he
that
does
touch.
Have a good sense of humor, which is a nice touch too. And kind of like Connery in the Bond films, he can joke around, he can be folksy, and he can be fun. But when it comes time to get lethal, that body can get tense and he can be scary.
And Hackman earned an Oscar for this performance. Completely deserves it. He plays this part with just as much cunning intimidation as he does charm and relatability. So that the audience is always going between liking him and fearing him and hating him.
Let's get into Gene Hackman's head for 1 minute. This is a guy who says he doesn't like violent roles. And he works with this friend, I assume it was his friend, Clint Eastwood. He worked with him again on Absolute Power several years later, playing a brutally awful president. Do you think Hackman liked his own character? Because actors almost always relate to or even like their characters. We mentioned this show so often, Breaking Bad. Bryan Cranston related to Walter White so much that they had to change the ending of that show just to appease their lead actor who had come to love his character. But if Gene Hackman hates violence, and this character, right or wrong, is extremely violent, as he may be playing a character, whenever they would have said cut, he's, okay, let me just think about something else.
Well, actors actors have to play detestable characters all the time. And
yes, but I think a lot of times they get into that and they like them, whether they admit it or not.
But that's just play acting, right? So just because somebody gets into, next week we're going to do Schindler's List and we're going to watch actors play some positively Nazis, detestable characters. I don't believe for 1 minute that Ralph Fiennes is as evil as the character he's portraying.
I sure hope not.
Right. So I trust that an actor can sink their teeth into a role even, and maybe especially if it's really counter to themselves and especially evil. And maybe there's a bit of a scratching an itch, and maybe his hatred of violence is a little bit that protests too much, because he's really good at playing these bad guys.
He has three AFI movies. Bonnie and Clyde was the first one. French Connection was the next one. His characters are very violent. He's played two cops now, and neither of them play by the book at all, though that's how you get famous in the movies, if you're going to play a cop. You can't be Mr. Nice Guy unless you're maybe Marge Gunderson in Fargo. You've got to toe that line, if not cross it. You mentioned Dirty Harry, maybe the ultimate example of that in the history of movies. Certainly a famous cops, guys who really come close to crossing the line, if not crossing it altogether. And that's the role, along with the spaghetti westerns, that made Eastwood so famous. But I asked that question because Hackman did win the Oscar over some famous names, like Jack Nicholson and Al Pacino. Nicholson in A Few Good Men. Great performance over the top, but a character he can probably relate to some extent. Pacino in Glengarry Glen Ross, David Paymer in Mr. Saturday Night. I've always thought Hackman was a good choice, but maybe not the best one. I think I'm convincing myself right now that he was acting more than most actors ever have to.
He stole the movie for me. He's fabulous in his performance. There's a lot of great performances in the movie. Eastwood always gets good performances out of his actors, and that's part of what he does best as a director. But Hackman's performance makes the film. It's so good.
Even his last moment on screen is that breath.
Yeah.
Nice that they show that. It's, I'll see you in hell, William Money. But that's not his last moment. It's his last line. His last moment is that intake of breath, which to me was fear. As it should be. He's about to have his head blown off, and he knows it.
And because death is scary. I think fear of death is a theme that keeps coming up over and over again. Money is terrified of death. When he almost dies from a fever, he has these nightmares. He sees his late wife, but she's being eaten by worms. He dreams he saw the angel of death, and it's not like a, oh, I saw the light.
He even sees a guy that he killed who was not a friend of his.
Yes. Whose identity he then pretends to Hendershot. Take on. Yeah, right. He says that's his name. Was it also William? He calls himself William Hendershot, doesn't he? He's terrified of death. He had to drink whiskey to do all of his crimes when he was younger to, I guess, numb the pain.
And that's when he becomes a badass in this movie, as soon as the prostitute is telling him.
It's like Popeye with his spinach. He's just got to drink that whiskey, and then he turns into a bloody killing machine. How he becomes a better shot when he's drunk, I don't know.
Like a Scorsese character, and we talked about this on Goodfellas extensively, William Money wants to be bad again, no matter how much he denies it. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you wholeheartedly on this. What did you like the least about this movie? Go ahead.
It's perhaps a little repetitive. That's what I mean when I said Eastwood plays to the cheap seats. How many times did he have to say out loud, I ain't like that no more?
You ain't like that no more. He and Ned say it a lot. They beat it to death. My biggest criticism of this movie, way back when I first saw it, I remember talking about this with an English teacher in college about this. I actually didn't like the movie at first because of that. I thought, come on, we know where this is going. I was a kid. I was not even 20 years old when I saw this movie. I knew where it was going to go because they beat that part to death, except that is a guy, much like Henry Hill, who deep down, whether he admits it or not, wants to be that again. And maybe because he knows he's bad at everything else. Why does he go off on the job in the first place? He's risking orphaning his kids who already lost their mother 3 years ago. And there's a character, by the way, very rare in any movie, but certainly in an AFI movie, who never is shown on screen. We know her name, Claudia. She died of what?
The pox.
Smallpox, who is hovering over a movie the whole time. She's the angel on her shoulder that he's letting sit there and letting sit there and listening to her. And then right when the prostitute's saying who he really is, because Ned had finally ratted him out just before he died, it's almost as if he swats that angel away and then takes that drink. No more Claudia, at least for now.
Although it's funny, everyone else in the movie seems to be motivated by their pride. A lot of why they do killing is because their pride's been hurt. Even the whore that gets cut up in the beginning, it's because she laughed at his penis and he's embarrassed. But Money doesn't seem to suffer that. He gets knocked down by the hogs and he just kind of seems to sigh, like, what are you going to do? He can't get on his horse, and he jokes about how it's punishment for all the mistreatment he did of animals in his past. And he doesn't honestly seem remotely bothered by his foibles and by the stuff that he's bad at. But as an audience, I don't think we're meant to believe that that is what's motivating him to kill. I think what's motivating him to kill is his own fear. And he has to master his fear by becoming the angel of death himself.
But let's say you were, I like to use sports analogies a lot, a pitcher, a quarterback, a whatever, and you're around 60, and somehow somebody said, you have one more shot at this, and you're going to earn money if you can just do this. Okay, just finish this job. Pitch in that one game and be good enough to win. Play in that one football game and be good enough to win. And in your post-sports career, you had nothing else you're all that good at. You tried to be an insurance salesman or run a car lot or whatever those guys do, and you're okay at best at it. Wouldn't you want that opportunity to be good at that one thing, even if it was only one more time, all over again, whether you deny it or not?
I think that's why Ned does it. I don't think that's why Monty does it. I think the film is saying that that's clearly not his motivation.
That's a good comparison, because when he rides over to Ned's place, the thing I said to you right then and there during the movie was, he's got a nice spread with Sally Two Trees. What's he doing? Why is he going off on this mission?
He liked being good at that. He missed it. But I think Money honestly needed the money. They really drive it home when I talk about them playing to the cheap seats. How many times do those kids have to say the Hogs have the fever? We get it. He's screwed if he doesn't do something. These kids are going to starve if he doesn't go out and risk his own life going back to do something he swore he would never do again. And you get the impression that he was an unhappy person. His wife made him happy. It wasn't just that he was worried about the state of his soul. He wanted to be redeemed, because otherwise why would he have let any woman tame him?
Except he is unforgiven. Now, you just mentioned Ned Logan and why he goes on this mission. Isn't it interesting that the three characters who go out there, James Wolvie, who plays the Schofield kid, and Money and Logan, two of them kill the Cowboys, one each, and one tries to but fails, and he's the only one who ends up dead. It is the black man. Ned Logan does shoot Davy off his horse, and that breaks his leg, and I guess he kills the horse, but he doesn't finish him off because he can't do it anymore. He tries to get away from there and really didn't actually do anything wrong, but he's the one they happen to capture, and he's the one they happen to kill. Maybe it's deliberate, maybe it's not. Probably it's deliberate. That's the black guy also. The other two who commit those murders, in the end, do get away scot-free.
It's nice that his part is written in a way that you feel like they could have cast anybody in that role, and they just cast Morgan Freeman because he was the best actor that was available, that they wanted to have the part. But if they had cast a white actor in that role, they wouldn't have had to change one line of the script, and I kind of like that about his character.
I remember when he and Tim Robbins talking about one of our future movies only a few weeks, The Shawshank Redemption, his other AFI film, and Charlie Rose asked them both what their favorite movies of their own were, and Freeman mentioned, I believe it was these four, Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, Shawshank Redemption, I think Glory was the other one. Driving Miss Daisy, we talked about Do the Right Thing, not a great film. He's wrong to like that one so much. It's curious he mentions this one because he's fine. Morgan Freeman's always good, but he is not necessarily irreplaceable in the role either. But he obviously liked working with Eastwood because then he won an Oscar for him in Million Dollar Baby many years later, which also wasn't one of his best performances, but that was a career achievement award more than anything else.
And critics love that movie for some reason. I like Eastwood mostly, but God, I hated Million Dollar Baby.
So let's talk about the killings of the Cowboys, because that's the whole point of the movie in the first place. They're both brutal, and they're certainly not clean and cool, as in Eastwood's spaghetti westerns. Davy is shot off his horse, and then he's shot through the gut, and he bleeds out, whining and crying. And as we agreed earlier, he's an honorable character in this whole film. He doesn't do anything to the prostitute. I guess you mentioned he holds her down, which is not very good, but otherwise he seems to be a sympathetic character.
He brings her a horse.
He apologizes more than anyone else ever does in the film to anyone else, certainly treats the woman with more respect than anyone else does. And then when he's dying, you feel for the kid because you've seen him have humanity.
And his friends are really upset that he's dying, too. These characters were just introduced to in the scene. We don't know anything about them. And they're heartbroken. They shot Davy Boy. That's their friend. They don't want him to die. And it's this little vignette of a scene of this whole story that took place outside of our purview and outside of Money's and Ned's and the kids' purview. They're horrified by watching this. They know that they're killing a perfectly good person just for the money.
Would you give him a drink? God damn it, we ain't gonna shoot. And then Quick Mike dies on the shitter, which is probably also more authentic than all these westerns where they stand in the middle of the road at high noon and shoot it out. The end of the movie is a shootout, but it's in a dark, rainy saloon in the middle of the night. It's not at high noon. It's not this whole big buildup. The spaghetti westerns are fun, but this feels way more real, the way things would have happened.
That's what makes it special, is there's an authenticity to the violence in all those westerns. Somebody would have, you always call it the constipation death. Somebody gets shot in the gut, they hold themselves.
And of course no blood.
No blood, they look kind of pained, and then they just fall off camera, and we never think about them again. But that's not what death is like. Death is messy. Death takes a long time. It's very painful. It breaks people's hearts. It's awful. Something to be feared and reviled. It's a great statement to make in westerns.
And at the end of the film, William Money, one out-of-towner, intimidates an entire town so much that he could have owned Big Whiskey if he wanted to. Instead, it's all these threats. If you don't bury Ned right, otherwise no cut-up, no horrors. I'll come back and kill every one of you sons of bitches. Makes you wonder how he could go back and live with his kids after the way he talks. That guy is as close to evil as you could really get. Right or wrong, he is fucking mad. And yet he's supposed to go back there and, hey kids, how's it going? Let's take care of these hogs again.
And surely he kills relatively innocent people in the saloon just because they're threatening his life.
He does say any man doesn't want to get killed, better clearing out the back.
After he kills five people.
No, no. He shoots Skinny and he trains his gun on Little Bill. And then the whole point is, if you guys don't want to get in the shootout, and obviously the deputies have to stay, but everyone else does leave, except for Beauchamp, that damn idiot. The starfucker following around everybody, he's going from one to another. He starts off with English Bob, and then he finds a better, more famous gunfighter in Little Bill, and then even better one, and he thinks at least, yeah, very briefly, in Will Money. And then nice comparison between him and the kid. There's mirror images so often, as we said, Bill and Will, but so are Schofield Kid and W.W. Beauchamp. They're not that similar in the obvious ways, except that they're both starfuckers who are in way over their heads, and in the end, they both are lucky to get out of this alive.
Yeah, I love the character of Beauchamp. He is not even embarrassed at what a chicken he is and how afraid he is of these gunfights when they actually start taking place, but he also has no shame about how much he loves the excitement of the action. He follows it around and he writes down these stories. He's a cipher for the audience, although maybe less a cipher for the audience. He represents all of us in a way that's not really flattering. I don't think that Eastwood wants us to leave the theater feeling like Beauchamp does, even though we can't help but get excited and revel in the violence of the film.
And he's not all that likable either. I don't think you're really supposed to necessarily root for him any more than anyone else.
That's my point, is he's representing the audience, but he's not a likable character.
But people that are pretty likable, even though they have a job that a lot of people could call issue with, would be the prostitutes. Frances Fisher is the leading one of them. She's going to be in Titanic. She's Kate Winslet's bitchy mother. And she is a feminist before feminism was even thought of as a concept. She is rough. She's tough. Contrast with Anna Thompson, who's the cut-up whore, who's heartbreaking in this film. She'd been in Eastwood's Bird before this, so she worked with him before. That misunderstanding, although Eastwood is lying to her about his wife Claudia being alive watching over his youngins, but it's a nice lie. It's not a mean-spirited lie by any means, but then I don't know how Strawberry Alice even knows the truth. His wife is dead. The poor girl's heart breaks all over again. Why did he lie to me then? He didn't actually want to fuck me after all. I am all cut up and ugly. And yet really what he was doing was a nice gesture to her. He can't sleep with any prostitute. He made this very clear. But I'd rather be with you than them others, I suppose. And he tells her a lie that isn't really a lie. And that whole sequence of those two, that little mini-story, it's kind of heartbreaking, I thought. Do you agree?
Yeah, I really loved her. She definitely gave the pathos that the film needed, because what happened to her is tragic, and we very quickly see the callous scene that takes place between Little Bill and Skinny about what will become these cowboys to punish them, and Little Bill's only concerned with Skinny's loss of this prostitute that he paid to bring over without any consideration paid to the fact that Delilah's, I guess, career as a prostitute is ruined, cut short. Her life is going to suffer as a result of this crime. No regard paid to that. No justice is expected for her. But also, it's not just their dignity they're fighting for, and they are fighting for their dignity, the prostitutes, when they hire these hitmen, when they put the bounty out. They need something that's going to deter other people. This is exactly how Little Bill operates. If somebody crosses the line with him, they pay with violence. They pay with bodily harm.
English Bob and William Money are beat up as badly as they are, more for show than for actual cause.
Exactly. So that's why Strawberry Alice is like, no, I will not accept your pony in payment. You are going to pay with your life, because it's not just about my life being worth as much as any of these men, and my dignity being worth as much as any of these men. It's about protecting myself and my girls in the future.
So it's a really strong feminist touch in this movie. And also, Eastwood does thank the women of Big Whiskey in his Oscar speech, which was a nice touch as well, because everyone's going to talk when this movie comes out about Gene Hackman, about Morgan Freeman, about Eastwood himself, and maybe even James Woolvey, the young up-and-comer they might have thought was going to be a star. Not that many people are going to focus on the women actors, but he made sure to do that during his Oscar speech, so good on him for that. During the end credits, we see a dedication to two old-timers who had died not long before. A nice touch by Eastwood, because they're mentors of his in these movies we've been talking about. The Dirty Harry movies with Don Siegel, and Sergio Leone did the Spaghetti Westerns. Siegel only died in April 91, so just before they started shooting the movie, and Leone was only a few years before that, so it's to Sergio and Don. And that ties into his movie past and the awful bloody shit that he'd been through. But Eastwood, he's up there in film icon status with the Duke. We've talked about this a few times. Who is the film icon? Who's the Babe Ruth of movies? It's so debatable. And there really isn't one in particular. I said John Wayne more than once. You said Marilyn Monroe. Especially since he's had this long career, really another career after this movie alone, which is just over 20 years ago. I think he's right there, pretty close behind John Wayne in icon status.
You know, they're not my kind of movie, so I'm going to let you be the authority on that, because I haven't seen enough Westerns or any of the Dirty Harry movies to really speak on it.
Well, just as far as quality goes from his acting performances, ironically, as good as he was in this film, he's better the very next year in In the Line of Fire, and even in his own A Perfect World, which he directed. We just watched it. We felt like seeing the Kevin Costner movie, because Costner is the star of that film, and Eastwood definitely is second billing in that film, literally and figuratively, because that is Costner's movie, and it's a damn good one, but he... Eastwood, that is wonderful in the Line of Fire. Have you ever seen that movie?
I love In the Line of Fire. Okay, yeah, I think it's a great movie. He didn't direct it, though. He just is.
No, one of the last movies he was ever in that he didn't direct. This is another interesting touch and an unfortunate one. He should have ended his career with a movie that people love. Gran Torino, because in that movie, spoiler alert, people probably know this movie was a very big hit. He goes down in a hail of gunfire. So it wasn't a Western, but that would have been his last on-screen moment. And he's saving his friends from possible death themselves, and certainly from an awful lot of trouble from these murderous assholes. But then he happened to be in an absolutely horrendous baseball movie called Trouble with the Curve, directed by somebody else, too. So he would have directed himself in his last screen performance, which was going to be his last screen performance, but then again, so was this way back when, going to be his last screen performance, Unforgiven. But he should have ended on that note and didn't. Oh, well.
I don't know. We fuss way too much about what an actor's last picture is. Maybe he just really likes acting. Maybe he would have rather spent the end of his career being in crappy movies than just resting on his laurels so that his legacy could have ended on this high note.
Well, his directorial career isn't over because he's made 34 movies as a director. He's also been a producer as long as a director since 1971. And he's got a movie in production called Sully, which is about the guy who landed the plane in the Hudson, Sullenberger, and Tom Hanks is going to play Sully.
Oh, people will love that. Yeah. And he had a massive hit, one of the biggest hits.
It was the biggest hit last year, American Sniper.
That's crazy. It was a good film. Controversy aside, it was not his best work. The film expressed opinions that are not really popular in Hollywood, so I can see why it struck a chord and made a ton of money. And it wasn't a bad film, but
highly mediocre at best. But Eastwood is a right-wing person. And I've heard him say many things lately, including the whole chair speech at the convention a couple years ago, that he's more right-wing than we would have thought. He seemed like a reasonable enough person. He's been quoted as being absolutely for gay marriage, or more indifferent to it. Why the fuck do I care if two guys want to get married? He's a complicated figure. I like him as a film star and an icon, but I don't know if I would want to be friends with him behind the scenes. However, I gotta give him more credit for his Oscar speech, because along with thanking the women of Big Whiskey, he thanked a lot of critics and even awards bodies in that, because he knows that's one of the reasons why that and then Million Dollar Baby was the same thing. That movie was made for a tiny budget, and it also made an awful lot of money, and he knows very well that that kind of thing succeeds because of people talking it up, like Roger Ebert's of the world and big-name film critics saying, this movie's great, go see it, over and over again, and making sure that people get out there. So there's a rare thing where somebody actually thanks the people that helped make his movie successful.
One of the critics I read said something that I think really sums up his career. It has ups and downs. It has great films and not as great films, but he never makes anything terrible. You can always expect his films to, at the very least, be above average and more interesting than the average film.
Well-crafted, for sure. He works with the same people over and over again, which we've talked about that plenty in the project, about the directors that use the same crew, often the same cast. Well, Eastwood's certainly no exception to that. We'll get to those people in just a minute. One more thing I want to say about him in this movie, though, is that like Costner in Dances with Wolves, there are nice touches of him being clumsy and weak. We've talked a little about the horse and falling around, that kind of stuff. What happened to your head? Did you get shot? Bumped my head, falling off my horse. It's pretty rare for a film star and a macho icon, like I said, to let himself look that bad, and he's done it many times since. And he also rarely cries, but he does in In the Line of Fire and Million Dollar Baby. So those are two examples of a guy who rarely loses it on screen and doesn't do a blubbering cry as it is, but does actually let it go a little bit. But I like that touch that in both of these cases, these last two Westerns we have on the list, this is the very last one we're going to do, Unforgiven, that these guys are not only imperfect, but they're clumsy and they're kind of dopey looking the way they're handling themselves. And they used to be great at this, or at least he used to be great at it.
His fallibility, his humanity, I think those are reflections of his maturity as a filmmaker. He grew up. He's not a young man. He doesn't have machismo anymore. And he's learned that characters who are human are just innately more interesting to audiences.
And he doesn't feel the need to have himself on screen all the time, because after we see the very beginning of the movie, which is his character in the opening prologue to explain who he is and the dead wife, we don't see him again for a while.
I think I said to you as soon as the movie was over, to me the story of the town and everything that was happening between the prostitutes and Little Bill and the other townspeople, to me was way more interesting than his arc as a character. He really lets those side characters come forward and have their place in the film, and that's part of what makes it great.
An old-fashioned Hollywood technique as well, where the stars don't have to be the entire story. Okay, we've talked a lot about the cast, but here's a few more people. Richard Harris is English Bob. He was in movies for 43 years. didn't make a lot of movies people are going to know. Major Dundee was an important title for him. And then Gladiator, not that long ago, well, 15 years ago, but it did win Best Picture.
He was the original Dumbledore.
And he was the original Dumbledore. That was my next thing. How many movies did he play Dumbledore in?
Just one, right? Just the first one.
No, the first two.
First two, and then he passed away, and he was replaced.
By Michael Gambon, right? Mm-hmm.
We haven't really talked much about English Bob yet and his character. There is talk that his whole character is superfluous in the film. Just kind of there to introduce W.W. Beauchamp.
But also to show us what he's going to do to people like this. And then when he beats on money, we know it's coming. Because that's another mirror image. The way it even goes down. The guy lies about a gun. When the sheriff finds a gun on him, he beats the living shit out of him.
I'm sure there's an argument to be made to say that his character is superfluous and you could have rewritten the script without him to save time. But between his character being interesting and fun and Richard Harris being such a great charismatic screen presence, would be a loss. You would miss him if he was gone.
He also has a line that's always bothered me. And I know it's deliberate. It's in the script. It's not Richard Harris improvising this, but the whole thing he talks about on the train about why not shoot a president. So let me get this straight. You shouldn't shoot anybody, of course, but if you had to choose between somebody who was just born into a family, and I hate royalty to begin with, but they're just born into a family versus somebody who was elected by the people, in his mind, it's more okay to shoot somebody who was elected by the citizens than some asshole who was born to some other asshole who happened to have blue blood.
He's just trying to rile up the locals and pick a fight so that he can have some legendary gunfight that Beauchamp can write about.
There's probably something to be said about the English character as well, because he's the only immigrant in the whole film. They're all these boring old modern Americans, because of course they were probably all born in this part of the world. None of them seem to have accents from somewhere else, like England. Okay, Saul Rubinek, who does play Beauchamp, has been in the business for 45 plus years. The very next movie he made, or at least the next year he made, True Romance. Anna Thompson is also in that. Anna Thompson is Delilah. 180 degrees from this character. This slimeball asshole producer. And he's terrific in that film. He wasn't born in Canada, but I do believe he's a Canadian actor. So it's probably one reason he was cast, because, of course, they shot the movie in this country. And he really does like to move on up the line as far as his allegiances go. He goes high up as it possibly gets. Maybe he becomes the mayor of that town. Well, although the mayor's not dead. Maybe he becomes the new gunfighter in the town because everyone else is fucking dead.
He's too yellow,
I suppose. Well, he's learned an awful lot of lessons in a very short period of time. James Wolveet is the Schofield kid. He is definitely Canadian. This was his first ever movie. A friend of mine actually knows him. He's made nothing since 2008. And I think it's because he had a brain tumor, so he's been recovering from that. And he's also a guy, like Beauchamp wants to do with the gunfighters, who's making himself into a legend because he lies repeatedly about what he's done and what he's achieved. Even the fact in the beginning that he's this great eagle eye, but then he proves he can't even see very far at all. But then it's about how he's killed five men and finally admits he didn't kill any. He just broke a guy's leg with a shovel until he does kill the one and only man he'll probably ever kill, and that is Quick Mike on the Shitter.
He's part of the generation of cowboys that knows the value of marketing. He's trying to brand himself. He gives himself the nickname Schofield Kid.
Right. Okay, we talked about Eastwood so much, there's really not much else to say. We talked about David Webb Peoples, the writer. Eastwood was his own producer. He did take home the directing and producing Oscars that night by himself, and he's been doing those jobs of directing and producing for 44 years and counting. God knows how much longer he's going to go, but he's in his 80s. I think he's about 85. If he's not 85 now, he's going to be sometime this year. He's born in 1930. His movie was 2:35:1, typical. He likes to shoot the movie in widescreen. We watched our DVD, nothing spectacular about it, looked all right. Jack N. Green, the cinematographer, a longtime Eastwood shooter. He made more than a dozen Eastwood movies. His last was Space Cowboys. Green went on to make comedies, but he did make a ton of movies with Eastwood before that. Eastwood's editor and the Oscar winner, in this case, Joel Cox, made 30-plus Eastwood movies, and he was an assistant editor on a movie you mentioned not long ago, The Wild Bunch.
I take issue with that, and this is totally minutia because I'm an editor and I wouldn't expect other people to notice the types of things that I noticed, but I felt like it was sloppy editing. There was all these places where performances could have been improved by tightening up here and there, where actors are supposed to be talking over each other, but they're clearly waiting for the other person to start talking when they should be interrupted. All these little things that I just thought, if I was doing a pass of that scene, then I would definitely tighten that up. But again, I don't think it's something that I would expect most people to notice.
You'd think other editors would notice that because they're the ones that, well, anybody can vote on the actual Oscars, but they're the ones who would have nominated him in the first place.
I know, I'm really surprised. It's not like it has spectacular, innovative use of playing with time or pacing or anything, so I'm not really sure how that happened. Maybe the other movies nominated weren't movies that got seen a lot.
I know A Few Good Men was one of them.
Wow!
The composer for Eastwood, yet again, he made 10-plus movies in this role, was Lenny Niehaus, I think that's how you say his name. But Eastwood did write the main theme, and then later he became Charlie Chaplin. He was not only the director, producer, and star, he never wrote his own movies like Chaplin did, but he became his own composer. But in this case, it was Niehaus who got the composer credit. And I got to mention this guy, Bummy, Henry Bumstead, because he worked on Vertigo and To Kill a Mockingbird, and he won Oscars for The Sting and To Kill a Mockingbird, and also worked with Eastwood a ton. They were longtime friends, and I believe Eastwood even mentioned him at some point, because he died not that long ago. Eastwood was in some award show, I believe, he paid tribute to Bummy, a longtime favorite of Eastwood and many other people in the business. The influence of Unforgiven. Let's start off with the debatability of its influence, because successful or not, and this movie did make about $100 million, Westerns dried up after this. We said this on Dances with Wolves. That movie was a monster hit. It made the top 200 box office mojo all time adjusted for inflation, which Unforgiven did not. Unforgiven was only a few years later. Tombstone was the year after this, and Wyatt Earp was the year after that. But then Westerns really weren't the same kind of film anymore. Kevin Costner's made Open Range. I mentioned that on Dances with Wolves. Modest success. But the genre kind of died. And based on that, why did this movie shoot up 30 spots on the top 100? 98th to 68th? Bev does not have an answer.
I'm thinking about it. I mean, I don't know.
Because influence is important. The movie was successful. People respect it. All those things are important. But I think influence is a big... I've said this before in other podcasts. I think that's one of the biggest reasons to put a movie on the top 100 list at all. And sometimes that's all you need. And this one doesn't really have it.
Well, maybe this was just his exceptional timing that he waited for the right time to release the film, because the genre of Western really had been played out and really wasn't appropriate for modern times anymore. So it was more like this elegy, this requiem for the Western
genre. And maybe people in Hollywood saw this and thought, well, we don't need to make anything else. Maybe other people tried to make Westerns and they said, well, Eastwood did it best already. That's it.
And the odd Western gets made now, but it gets made with its own very modern spin. You really don't see traditional Westerns anymore. It's something like True Grit, and I'm sure that Hateful Eight is definitely going to have its own spin. I mean, Django was in a way a Western as well, but not traditional at all.
Well, there is a Japanese remake that they made in 2013 starring Ken Watanabe. Let them gunfight. That probably wasn't in the movie, but it should have been. So I've never seen it, but there you go. Unforgiven with Ken Watanabe. And then people says Taxi Driver was one of the major influences on his script. Let's bring it back to Westerns before that. Taxi Driver was influenced by The Searchers very directly.
So Money, the character is successful. He survives. There's an epilogue that even says, and then he went to San Francisco and was successful in all of his endeavors.
He was good at two things. He was good at something else.
Yeah. From that moment on, it's almost as if that's what he needed to do to move on and have his family succeed. That's the wrong ending. It's not a terrible ending, but it's not a perfect ending. He needed to die.
Like in Gran Torino.
Self-destructive, and he had so much self-loathing. I feel like his character really needed to die to not be 100% successful, because that kind of defeats the meaning of the film that is a condemnation of violence.
Shane is a nice little comparison in some ways to this film. And he remade Shane as Pale Rider. It's not nearly as good, because it just feels like, what are you doing this for? They already did it in 1953. Why are you doing it in 1985 or something? But in that film, it's debatable whether or not Shane's going to live. People say he definitely is about to die. People say he's definitely not about to die. But in that film, he's definitely bloodied, and it doesn't look good for him long-term at the very least.
Yeah, even if he's not dead, he's lonely. He didn't succeed, because for him, success would have been happiness and settling down with a woman, having a family like the family that he's now, leaving because he feels like he has to. He is going to suffer, and he didn't even have the same checkered past that Money does.
Oh, I think he does. We just don't know about it.
Maybe you're right. Yeah, okay. But at any rate, he's not successful at the end. He has a kind of sad ending. No matter how you interpret it, whether he's alive or dead, his ending is sad. Whereas there's no room for interpretation. Money's ending is happy.
Maybe that's what he's doing all over again, Eastwood here. Maybe he is turning that on its head as well, that his hero, who definitely should pay in every way, doesn't really pay in every way. He gets the money. He succeeds. Yeah, he loses his friend. He has to go back to what he was. But then it sounds like he was able to turn that back off again on his ride home. He can hit that switch, and I'm no longer a sadistic killer. He's telling people, I'll come back and kill every one of you.
Do you like the ending?
I don't really take issue with it. Shane's definitely a better ending as a Western. Wild Bunch, I mean, God, they all die. Hundreds of other people die along with our main characters, and they willingly do it. And The Searchers, the guy lives, but he might as well be dead. His soul certainly is dead. All these Westerns maybe did it smarter than this one at the end, but maybe that's Eastwood just turning it on its head all over again and saying, I'm going to go against all these typical things in a Western, the way we're going to handle all the deaths and make it all painful and awful. Not really all that bloody, actually. And at the end, I'm going to survive against all odds.
Maybe it's just another case of a Walter White, where you have an actor that fell so in love with his character and had enough clout and power that he just couldn't let it go, couldn't let him have an unhappy ending.
Yeah. Okay, the awards and list section is not extensive, but here we go. 4 Oscars only, but it did win these. Best Picture, Best Director, Eastwood took those both home. Supporting Actor for Gene Hackman is 2nd of 2 Oscars, because he won for The French Connection quite a long time ago. Incidentally, that was the last time we saw him on the AFI list, and that was 31 movies ago. And it also won for Joel Cox's editing, which Bev takes issue with. The five failed nominations. Eastwood as Best Actor. That was his first ever nomination. And I remember reading somewhere that he thought, I'll never win. And he made some, we'll say, disparaging remarks about Jewish people in Hollywood. Well, he said something like, I'm not going to win because I'm not Jewish and I'm not a liberal and I'm not all these other things. I don't know if he meant it to sound as anti-Semitic as he did, but I read that when I was reading reviews and such on this film. So Eastwood for Actor, the screenplay by Peoples, the cinematography by Green, the sets by Bummy, and then the sound. That would have been a very worthy win. And it is the rare Western to win an Oscar. Cimarron, back in 1931, won, and then Dances with Wolves, only 2 years before, are the only three that have ever won and are Western films. It made the National Film Registry in 2004. That was the same year as Ben-Hur, Schindler's List, our next film, and one of your favorites, Swing Time. Unforgiven was fourth in the Western category of the top 100 genres. That's not much of a surprise. And the failed AFI list, there are a few of them here. The top 100 thrills would have been a pretty good choice for that. Top 100 quotes with, it's a hell of a thing killing a man, and then the rest that came after that. And then, as we said, Money and Daggett as heroes and villains. We both liked the movie. Was it a top 100 film, though? And more importantly, should it have shot up 30 spots? That is almost as much as anything else, other than The Searchers and City Lights, which shot up way more than even that.
Where it belongs on the list, on the top 100, yes, I would probably put it in the bottom 50 rather than the top 50. And I'm going to say something really controversial here. I think Unforgiven is a better movie than The Searchers.
Not many people agree with you on that one.
No.
Well, if we had to choose which one to watch again, Unforgiven is more entertaining and less dated and certainly less racist because there are no natives, no quote-unquote Indians, the way there are in The Searchers.
And less annoying because it doesn't have the elaborate subplot of his little tag-along buddy.
Yeah, Jeffrey Hunter and all his exploits. That movie's trying to be funny at times, though. This one has the humor, but it's at the expense of our main character more than anyone else in the film. Not many other people are funny, except the main guy, ironically, at his own expense. Okay, good film. I'd put it in the top 100, I suppose, but definitely not 68th. But I do respect it, and I will see it again. Up next on the top 100 project is the good time, happy fun Holocaust epic, Schindler's List, and we have broken precedent. We've actually seen the movie already because we want to make sure we can get through it when we had a spare moment, so we won't talk about it yet, but Bev already would have some thoughts.
And I can finally say that I have seen every single movie on both top 100 AFI lists.
Yay! So what's the last
one? Pop your champagne.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Schindler's List. It finished in the top 10 on both of AFI's 1998 and 2007 top 100s. It's the last movie that did. How many times did Schindler's List have a top 10 finish on any other AFI list? And I'm talking anything. Comedies? Well, not there. Passions? You name it.
I already know what one of them is because it came up in a very recent trivia question.
All right.
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast for Schindler's List. You can also find lots more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, on our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach Ryan and I personally, we love to get emails from you guys, so send us a message at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I'd just like you to know that I ain't like that no more.
And cut.